Accession number 25182, Reel 1.
Sir Robert Atkinson, Reel 1. Could I start by asking you a little bit about your background? Can you tell me when you were born and where that was?
Yes, I was born in Tynemouth, Northumberland, March the 7th, 1916.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
Yes. My father served in the First World War, in the army, by the way, as a volunteer, and he was trained before the war. He was injured in the Battle of the Somme, where he had his leg rather badly wounded, but went through the war and was demobbed in 1919. I remember the occasion quite clearly because I was 3 at the time, and they had these victory tees in the street, and I remember quite clearly having that tee in the street and taking part in the celebrations.
Could I ask, were you an only child?
Not at all. There were 5 boys and 1 girl.
And what did your father do after the war?
Sadly, when my father came back from the war, he couldn't get his job back, which I felt was, to this day, I feel, was a prime example of a social injustice, having served as a volunteer for 5 years and being wounded. He started a small business in building, but he was not a successful businessman. My mother was of Quaker stock, and she was the dominant partner and managed the family in its entirety. She guided us through our early education, training, and subsequently, as she got older, she became deeply interested in, and was all her life, the guiding light in the family.
Could I ask you, were you educated in Northumberland?
Yes. My education, yes. I was a grammar school boy by scholarship, did moderately well at school, could have done better if I'd worked harder, but I was too keen on football.
And what determined your subsequent career, first in the Merchant Navy and then in the Royal Navy?
Well, in 1932, when I left school, 1927 to 32 in the grammar school, you have no idea how difficult things were on Tyneside. The unemployment was dreadful. My eldest brother, had gone into the Navy. My other 2 brothers were working. And I decided to follow my eldest brother and go to sea. I'm glad I did, because my wonderful mother said, "Shake the dust of this town off your heels. There's very little here for you." And I went into the merchant service as a midshipman, served my 4 years in tramp ships, subsequently took my various examinations and qualified as a master mariner, and an extra master mariner.
Can you tell me a little about life in the Merchant Navy at that time?
Life in the Merchant Navy at that time is extremely hard. The allowance per day per man would be 1 and 6 pence per day, which had to provide for food. This was a crew of, say, 40, 50. My first salary in my indentures was The first year's payment was £10 per year, £12 for the second year, £18 for the third year, and £20 for the fourth year. And after 4 years of good conduct, you received the princely bonus of £5. So there was not a lot of spare money around. Life on board was very difficult. I found that I was of them, but not one of them. Their pleasures and activities were not related. I became a very serious student. Didn't always go ashore, had no money to go ashore. And I studied very carefully, basically astronomy and mathematics, which were of always a great appeal to me. But I met some very fine men, hard-working men, the salt of the earth. Those were the men in command of convoys, of convoy ships later. Very fine men. To get command of a merchant ship in those days, you had to have a very good record and a reliable person, because communications were very slim. You took the ship to sea, you found your way to where you had to go, with very little help, a magnetic compass, and if you were lucky, an echo sounder. Not like you have today. They were highly trained men, and by and large, it formed my career and life, probably, my attitude to work, loyalty, etc.
What were the living conditions like for you on board?
Rather poor, four cadets, four midshipmen in one cabin, no bathroom. To have a bath, you had to have a shower, which meant you walked the length of the after deck, which was probably 60 yards on a steel deck, and shared the bathroom or facilities, which was open concrete floor and water, with another 30, 40 men.
And what parts of the world did you visit?
All over. You name it, I have been there. Black Sea, White Sea, Red Sea, Yellow Sea, Vladivostok, Australia, New Zealand. I think I've been to most parts of the world.
You mentioned that you took a number of exams. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yes, the examinations you took in the merchant service, of course, were second mate, then first mate, then master. Very few people took extra master. That was an academic, more like a degree in nautical astronomy. I hadn't a bad intellect, and I found no difficulty with these examinations.
How long were you in the Merchant Navy?
Six years.
And how did it come about that you transferred to the Royal Navy?
My eldest brother was in the Royal Navy, and I followed his example and applied to join as a reserve officer. I was duly accepted, and after, I think, 6-7 years in the merchant service, I joined the Navy for training, which was towards the end of 1938, just before the Munich crisis. I took the long course, which was a very long course of 12 months training. And that 12-month training ended in August 1939.
Can you tell me where that training was and what it entailed?
Yes, it entailed training in the barracks, in naval life, discipline, performance, where you served under a petty officer, various aspects of naval background. I thought too much emphasis on the life of Nelson rather than the size of our guns compared with the Italian and the German Navy. I thought too much emphasis on tradition. But it was a good training. I served in a cruiser, I served in submarines, I served in destroyers.
Was that after your training had been completed?
Both. You did training in the barracks, you did sea training, and more training in the barracks.
Which barracks were you?
Royal Naval Barracks, Devonport, and Royal Naval Barracks, Portsmouth.
Can you tell me what the living conditions were like?
Oh, entirely different. The living conditions ashore were excellent. Very exacting time. Early morning appearances, dress for dinner, good food. An entirely different life from the merchant service. They expected you to perform. The training was there. You were graded according to the results of the little tests and examinations you had to accept.
Did you specialise in any particular branch at that stage?
No, you weren't allowed to specialise in anything at that time as a reserve officer.
How did you adapt to the discipline of naval life after the merchant marine?
Fine. It was needed. I wanted it. I liked it. I've applied that discipline in business and my private life ever since. Joining the Royal Navy was probably one of the best things I did, because at that stage it formed my attitude to life and my conduct in life and in business, in my business career also.
Did you ever fall foul of the rules and regulations when you were a trainee officer?
No, not at all. In fact, rather fun. I played cricket and I made the mistake of bowling in the third ball the middle stump of the commander of the barracks. And my friend said, "Your naval career is marked from now on, young fellow." Even worse, the same night the commander of the barracks asked me to play him at snooker and I beat him. And they said, "You might as well leave the Navy, you have no future." Most enjoyable. An entirely different kind of person. Some of the finest people I've ever met, I met in the Royal Navy.
Can you remember anything about your training at sea?
Do you mean before the Navy or after, during the Navy?
When you were training as a reserve officer, you said that there was some, the training entailed training at sea.
The training at sea was not all that wonderful, because by the time I joined the Navy, I was a trained seaman. Remember, the Merchant Navy spent much more time at sea than the Royal Navy, and I was already a qualified navigator. The training we did at sea was largely gunnery exercises and coordinating with submarines and other aspects of naval ships.
After that training was completed, what happened to you?
Oh, they appointed me to... first I was in the Curaçao and then did the training. And then after the training was completed, I was appointed to HMS Brilliant, and also HMS Winchelsea.
What sort of vessels were they?
Destroyers.
And what was your role on board?
What was
your job on board?
Just as an additional officer, a watch-keeping officer.
And what did those responsibilities entail?
Taking your turn as a watch-keeping officer at sea, which meant on the bridge, ensuring that the ship was in position or whatever was required, and basically operating at a ship as an officer.
What were your living conditions like on board?
Very good. Quite small for space, but again, different type of man in a destroyer from, say, a cruiser or the big ships. The small ships' men are more dynamic, you might say, but the conditions were excellent.
Were you in the gun room?
Yes.
Can you describe what that meant and what that was like?
The gun room you have in a larger ship like a cruiser, there's no gun room in a destroyer. You're just an ordinary officer. Gun room conditions are fairly tough. You get no privilege. You're a midshipman, among others, and you live, that is your part of ship, you might say, in which you recline after duty, and you live among the other midshipmen, and you have to measure yourself and live with them. Quite competitive, by the way.
By that stage, had war already broken out?
No. When I finished my training towards the end of August, I went home with the view to returning to sea, and immediately I was called back and appointed in command of HMS Lorna, a palatial yacht owned by Sir Walter Preston, chairman of the Midland Bank, in Southampton, and told to proceed forthwith to Gibraltar for contraband control duty.
That was your first command?
My first command.
Can you tell me what your reaction was to receiving your first command at really quite an early stage in your Royal Naval career?
To be quite truthful, I was very worried and concerned. Had I got it right? Was I good enough? I was supposed to take the ship to Gibraltar, and war had begun. The only equipment we had was a magnetic compass. We didn't even have an echo sounder, and some charts. And I hoped that my navigation was correct. We had no means of checking that. And after about 8 days at sea, when I saw the Rock of Gibraltar and the horizon, I was greatly relieved to note that my navigation had been correct, since en route we had no means of finding our position by sextant or chronometer. It had been overcast all the way.
So this had been a private yacht that had been commandeered for
war? Yes, yes, yes.
How big was the ship's company?
About 47. Mostly fishermen from Highlands. Fine seamen, fine men. Not quite trained in naval ways, but adjustable. The accommodation was unbelievably good. For example, the saloon dining table was in gimbals, so that nothing would be swept away as and when the ship rolled.
And what was your accommodation like?
Well,
a state room or
almost, in fact, quite embarrassing, because my bunk was a very large, broad bunk, and it had a small communicating door to the next cabin, which caused great amusement when we reached Gibraltar. News spread about this lovely ship, and certain senior officers asked to come down and have a look at the ship, and the hatch to the next cabin was of great amusement to these senior officers, who were not short of imagination as to what went on in the private yacht.
How old were you when you took command?
23.
What happened when you got to Gibraltar?
We immediately were on duty between the north coast of Africa and the Rock, and all ships coming through into the Mediterranean were checked. What cargo, etc., etc. Now, it wasn't quite like that, because we were warned what ships were coming through. Very seldom did a ship come through unexpectedly. And our intelligence would tell us, for example, XYZ is coming through the Straits and from Brazil, and apparently has, say, a cargo of salt. Send the ship in, because below the salt there are other parcels. And I would send boarding officers on board. We stopped the ship, sailed around her with a gun pointed towards her, and sent two officers in a boat who would talk to the captain and say, where are you coming from, what are you doing, etc., 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 by conversation, albeit they were under firm orders that that ship had to be sent in. Sometimes great protestations from the captain. Sometimes we had to fire a gun and threat, or call for a destroyer to come out from the rock. But they always went in the end, and very cleverly done by our Secret Service. They might say, we would like to look at number two hole, do you mind? And they dig down a number two hole and find parcels of diamonds, industrial diamonds, special equipment that they might need under the coal or under the salt. So it was an interesting job, but a rather boring job, parading back and forwards, waiting for a ship to come through. That wasn't my idea of a war. And I asked to be sent as soon as possible to the real war.
And when was that?
That was about after 6 months. I was there in September 39, about March.
You wanted to be moved to what you described as the real war.
Yes, I applied for what they called special service. That could be anything. Did you speak French? Did you speak German? Could you go into submarines? And no response at all. Well, on patrol one night, we noticed a ship creeping through on the North African side inside territorial waters. Ships coming through the Straits were instructed not to go into territorial waters. So something was amiss. We shouldn't have done it, but I went into territorial waters and stopped this ship called the Cellina, an Italian ship. He protested. We fired a gun across his bow, called the rock, asked for help. We didn't need it in the end. I ordered him into Gibraltar. That ship was a prize ship. It was just before Italy came into the war. She was laden to the gills with 7 million gallons of petrol. I was rather pleased with myself. Capture a ship and its cargo. Even more pleased when the commander-in-chief, by virtue of his staff, heard that I wanted to go to the real war. So they said, okay, you're a qualified officer, take the Cellina home to England. Mark you, they had resisted many things. All important doors were locked and the keys were thrown away when we got that ship in. But the Italians were removed, and I brought that ship home in convoy to Weymouth Harbour and left her there.
You say she was a prize ship?
Yes.
Can you explain what that meant for you?
Well, in the old days of Nelson, if you captured a prize ship, you were given that ship, your crew, was given the worth of that ship. So, in the old days, you got the value of the ship, the value of the freight, and the value of the cargo. I have to tell you that after the war, I was awarded the princely sum.
Oh, could you just, sorry, you've moved a bit too close to the microphone. Can I just move that? Yeah, thanks. And if you could.
After the war, I was awarded the princely sum of £124 with compliments and thanks from the Prime Minister, Mr. C.R. Attlee. That was my first experience of government generosity.
Did the rest of the crew get a share as well?
Probably, but I was in. That crew was entirely spread out then. They probably got less because I was the commanding officer. So I would think that the ordinary seaman probably got £20-30.
After you'd taken the ship back to Weymouth, what happened then?
A couple of weeks' leave, promptly appointed to HMS Osprey, which was the anti-submarine training base. Did a month or 6 weeks course there in anti-submarine warfare. Appointed immediately to HMS Rhododendron, which was building in Harland and Wolff, Belfast.
Does that mean that you were part of the skeleton crew that helped prepare the ship for the rest of the crew to come on board?
Yes. The ship was building, and I was there with probably two or three more, and for about a month before the ship was commissioned and sent to Tobermory for training.
What did your training consist of? What sort of things?
Exercises with submarines. We had a tame British submarine in the Minches, and we'd go out and exercise with her and get attuned to a radar, to ASTIC contact, the sound, how it was approaching, how it was receding. There would be training officers explaining the quality of the noise, what it meant, Doppler effect, and all this sort of thing, with one of our own submarines before being dispatched to convoy duty.
How did you feel being moved from surface ships to submarines? So how did you adjust to being moved from surface vessels to submarines?
Well, I wasn't being moved to submarines. I was anti-submarine. We were training how to deal with submarine attacks and how to attack submarines. That was the basis of the training in Tobermory. Hence the tame British submarine, which is exercising below surface, coming to surface, and so forth and so forth.
Sorry, my fault. I misunderstood what you were saying. Yes, of course. And once your training was completed,
yes,
did you remain on the HMS Rhododendron?
Yes, it was rather interesting in as much that we didn't complete our training. Halfway through our training, we were told to proceed with all due dispatch, 5 o'clock on a winter's night, to the island of Tiree, where HMS Sturdee had run aground at 20 knots, many men injured, on the west coast of Tiree, pick them up. Well, not an easy thing to do, because on the east side, there was the tiniest of tiniest harbour, tiniest of tiniest harbour, where no man in his right senses would take his ship. But I had always learned that Admiralty would be sympathetic to anyone injuring or their ship, damaging their ship, if loss of life was involved. By the grace of God, at daylight the next morning, with a westerly gale blowing, I took that ship into the harbour. Sorry, the southeasterly gale blowing. Which meant you couldn't turn round because you were facing Clipside, small harbour. Again, by the grace of God, we anchored, turned the ship, came alongside a tiny jetty, and picked up 120 men, of which about 10 were quite severely injured. Brought the ship back to Oban, landed our human cargo, went back to Tobermory. Monkey Brand Stevenson, the admiral, that's what we called him, he was a firebrand. Right, he said, that's enough, you can join a convoy, no further training necessary. So off we went to meet our first convoy.
Sir Robert Atkinson, Reel 2.